So I first met Nick Land at Langley Park School, which is kind of West Wickham in Kent. It was a grammar school at the time, so we like to think of ourselves as pretty smart kids. Even though it's a state school, you're getting a pretty good education. The Butler Report after the Second World War made sure that smart, poorer kids could get a really good education, and we did. About halfway through my time at Langley Park, the Labour Education Secretary Shirley Williams turned it into a comprehensive school. So my brother's year, which was 3 years below me, and other years below that, they've all been comprehensive. But I mean, Nick, I first met, I was in the same year as him. I was in classes, so I kind of knew him through various. I think we were doing physics, maths, and things like that in the same class. But I got to know him much more through chatting, literally out at lunchtime on the playing field as we were all running around. And there were some interesting characters there. Nick was the most interesting by far. And even though he was known as Nazi Nick at school, and sort of a bit shunned by a lot of people, I mean, we had the deputy head of the school, Ken Wilby. He'd been tortured in prison camps. I think it was a Japanese one anyway, in the Second World War. So this idea that you had a Nazi school kid running around was pretty extraordinary in the 1970s. And I quickly realized that Nick was a specifically incredibly knowledgeable guy. I mean, I was at school to learn. I realized that I'm sort of sitting thinking, well, okay, so I'm 14, 15, and I'm at a decent school. I might as well use this time to learn. Obviously, we're socializing as well. We got mates and running around. We get, there's all sorts of things that happen with kids, like bullying, that sort of thing. I got quite badly bullied at certain times. But well, I was there to learn. That was what I was there to do. And Nick, actually, I found that I was learning more from Nick than I was from any of the classes, any of the schools. So they're teaching us specific stuff. Like physics, whatever, maths, English, I did biology, things like that. But Nick had this amazing broad knowledge, which was for me was like a magnet. He knew about everything. He knew about particularly about psychology, about war, about the history of war. He was really enthusiastic about the Vietnam War, and he was excited about all of the new methods of war which were being used there, these sort of things like defoliants, napalm. This was Nick's thing. It was like he seemed to be really, really interested in war technology, and he was also into gaming. So this is the year here is around about 1976. For probably 2 years, most Saturday afternoons, I would be around at Nick's house playing games. He, there was a few others, Bob Kepler, Rob Smith, both of whom I'm still in touch with, who went round to see Nick every, well, almost every Saturday. And obviously we're doing things with the family some weeks, but he had it around about five or six of us who we would play board games and war games. These are the Avalon Hill SPI style tabletop war games. So this is what I was doing aged 14, 15, 16. Was learning how to fight wars with Nick.
So, what was your, if you could sum up your first impression of him, what set him apart from other people?
Well, extremely intelligent, I would say, but more than that, knowledgeable. His knowledge was vast. And I don't think I quite realized it at the time, but as time went on, towards the sixth form at Langley Park, because we both went on to the sixth form, but we weren't really friends in the sixth form. It was sort of obvious to me that he'd had some other education outside the school. I mean, unless he'd read some book which was just, had all the knowledge of the world in it or something. No, I think he was fast tracked, somehow. I have no idea. And also, he used to disappear for times. I have no idea where, like the summer holidays, 1978. We went out, we had a camping flight, free camping holiday, down in Bath and Wells down there, walking in the countryside. And then after it, Nick just disappeared. I'm phoning him up Nick, well, and speak to his mum. Oh, Nick's not around at the moment. Okay, right. So,
Mm.
yeah, yeah. So, as a personality, he was charismatic, always lots of dark humour, but characterised by just a vast knowledge. And anyone that wanted to learn stuff, it doesn't matter if it's a Nazi. A lot of people have asked me, did you? Why were you hanging out with a Nazi, Tony? Well, that's a really good question. And the answer was because it's the same reason I joined the Air Training Corps and the which is part of the Royal Air Force when we were at school. Nick did too. But you're joining something, as I did with Nick, not necessarily buying into it. Like, I never pursued a career in the Royal Air Force, which they would obviously have preferred I did. But I was at a stage of my life where I'm picking up loads of stuff. When you're 15 years old, your brain is like a sponge. You just want to learn
Yeah.
and know everything. And Nick was the guy. He just knew everything. And although I didn't ever really buy into any of his sort of racial supremacist stuff. And he was very much like that. Even carving a swastika into the desk at our Jewish physics master Martin Black's physics lab, that sort of thing. I didn't buy into that,
Yeah.
but Nick knew everything. So he's obviously, if you want to learn, he's the guy to hang around. And also, it was really unique. All this stuff to do with wargaming, at that age, you're up for that. Let's stop. We finished the era of playing. Play fights and sort of pretend guns at each other. Let's find out what war's really about.
So, was he well known among his peers? Was he more of a background figure, or was he like was there a lot of attention to him? Was he
Well, look, I mean,
bullied? Was
imagine,
he
look,
well known?
imagine you've got a person here who's a Nazi. Look, most people shunned him really because of the Nazi
Yeah.
stuff. And I've tried to explain, I hope, why I didn't. I mean, he was known. Yes, he was known. In fact, I'm at the moment, there's a Facebook group to do with our old school. And people remember him. I put a piece up about, oh, here's Nick. He's in the news because there was a big Tucker Carlson interview which focused on him quite a lot. And he did a response to it, and other people did responses to him, and so that was 2025, and yeah, a lot of people say, oh yeah, I remember this guy, so he was kind of, he wasn't hiding or anything like that, but he was just
Yeah.
shunned quite a bit because of his politics.
So, how did it in his school years, how did Nick interact with authority? Because I know I can get kind of the gist from what you've said. He wasn't very positively interacting with authority, but was he quite rebellious? You said that in our phone call, he was quite rebellious. Could you expand on it?
Well, I mean, he was, but he wouldn't do too much, have too much. He wouldn't be rocking the boat so much as to come to too much attention. I mean, his rebelliousness, I think, was in his mind mainly, and also he was, we would go over to his house on a Saturday afternoon, and fairly regularly, Nick would decide, because he was most definitely in charge. You know what I mean? It was his little operation. The what he called we called Diplomacy Club. We would play the game Diplomacy sometimes, but mostly other games. And sometimes, particularly in the summer, Nick would decide, right, we're going out on manoeuvres today. So we would be out on Hayes Common, which is was just opposite his house, Sandacres, on Warren Road. And it out on the common there would be manoeuvres. Nick would be the leader. And we would be basically doing guerrilla training, guerrilla army training. We'd be crawling around like commando crawling, and also sort of spying on people who are just walking their dogs. The idea is, right, everyone be quiet now, and we watched them as they went past. I mean, it sounds childish, but it was another aspect to Nick's interest in war was he set up this thing called the British Free Army, the BFA, which never had any sort of thing official. It was just a bunch of us. And so we would be doing guerrilla warfare training. The idea was we were sort of, I don't know, insurgents or paramilitaries or something. Obviously, nothing really drastic happened,
Yeah.
but the idea was you were just we're just doing training to cope out in the middle of nowhere. Now, I mean, I've known people who've been in the military, and you know, if you're going out for a walk with them, sometimes they will suddenly turn into their sort of military camouflage mode, and Nick was like that, you know. So
Yeah.
you like there's someone coming, they haven't seen us, you know, and so the idea was that you were using the terrain, the common in this case, as a sort of place to hunt your enemy, you know, the unsuspecting enemy, even if they were just someone walking their dog, you know. Obviously they weren't really an enemy, but we were, you know, Nick was training us.
Yeah. So did he have a circle of friends? Did he have a wide circle of friends, or did he kind of keep to a small group of people?
But it was fairly small, and it was mostly around our diplomacy club. I mean, after I got to know him, or he, because the summer of 1978, I went with some friends, Ian Bateman and Lawrence Peter, on holiday with Nick, where we had a week or a couple of weeks, I think it was, at the beginning, just before the summer holidays, after the exams and before we got our results. O level results, down to, as I said, down to Somerset and Bath. And when we got back to school for the lower six to start our A levels, Nick just didn't want to know me. You know, he's like off in another world. He'd become a communist. And I mean, actually, I was quite interested in communism, but he obviously saw me as his fascist friend. What happened then was we weren't really, I wasn't going around to his house on Saturdays anymore. But who was? Well, it was my younger brother who knew his younger brother. My brother, who with his some of his friends were going around to Nick. So it was almost as if Nick was meeting people at school. My brother, who he met through his brother John, who was the same age as my brother, 3 years younger. And Nick would select, right, these are going to be my little crew to train up, whether it's wargaming or on the common or wherever. And so he sort of picked his own friends, really.
What do you remember about the house itself? Like, what was the atmosphere in the Land household?
Lovely, really nice, very nurturing. His mum was really kind, very thoughtful, gentle. And, you know, she would bring us sandwiches in the afternoon and a cup of tea. Sort of for, I don't know, like 4 o'clock or so, and we would usually stay till maybe about 7, then run back home for supper, you know. And so yeah, it was very good. His dad was there occasionally, mostly not there. He had a sister too, who kind of kept herself to herself. And he's yeah, but he, when his dad was there, he was quite, I would say, very, very nice, very but aloof, kind of. You know, sort of wafting around, which is a bit strange. But the interesting thing about his father, Nick told me, he was a director of Shell, and in South Africa. Now, I've no idea if that's true or not, but he was, yeah, he wouldn't really talk to us much. He was quite cagey, you know, I wouldn't say cagey, but he just didn't want to talk about what he did at all. He's at home, you know, of course. Why would you want to? But that I thought was interesting. This whole sort of connection with South Africa, the white supremacists, which was very much in the 1970s still the thing.
Yeah.
And of course there is this 1970s, 60s, 50s connection with the Technocracy Inc. as well, which is, you know, the families of Elon Musk, Peter Thiel. I think he's born in Germany actually, but a lot
Yeah.
of these people are connected with South Africa. I don't need to spell that out, but there's lots of, but what happened in the war, Second World War, was a lot of the Nazis around the empire went to South Africa because South Africa would, they could sort of almost hide there basically and carry on being Nazis and no one would notice or mind because of the Rhodes legacy and because of, you know, obviously apartheid going on down there. So you've got the white supremacist stuff anyway happening in South Africa. It's a happy place for British Empire Nazis to hang out. But
Yeah.
it was always very nurturing, friendly, lovely place. You know, really nice in his house, as it was in most of my friends' houses, to be honest. You know, it was, but it was particularly friendly. I do remember getting very, very drunk at a party there once on Scotch whiskey and passing out. at Nick's place, and unfortunately, his mum tried to move me. She was going to take me back home in her car, and or maybe his dad, I'm not sure, because I was obviously unconscious, and I threw up all over the back seat of the car, apparently, which is not a very good thing to do. So they left me in managed to manhandle me up to Nick's room and left me, and I came round about 11 o'clock the next morning with a terrible hangover and kind of hobbled home. But but it was a they were a fantastic lot, and in fact maybe that was why I was told no, we don't want to be friends with this guy anymore, he's a bit difficult. But anyway, it's interesting because my brother carried on with some of his friends going round to Nick's regularly.
So what was Nick's relations like with the siblings? Do you know them?
Well, yeah, I mean, John was nowhere near as sort of sparky as Nick was. His sister was quite reclusive. I mean, I say that because I think, when she was a bit younger than us, and she doesn't really want to be around the boys. Girls are like that; they'd much rather be with the girls. And she was really the only thing I can remember about her. I can't remember her name, but she was really into pigs. I always remember thinking, I think I need to keep away from her because she's kind of obsessed with pigs, and I'm not sure why. But anyway, that's up to her. She had like a collection of pigs in her bedroom, which was just like every single spare space was there was a pig there. I don't know why. It was every different type, like Miss Piggy times 10. And anyway, but they're really all really nice people. And my attitude to Nick today is still really great, nice bloke, and I know he's obviously he is a Nazi. He's still a Nazi. He is trying to start a world war. I think that's obvious. But that's his thing, But as a person, I'd be really, because I haven't spoken to him for a long time, since I think 1993. But I've put requests in to interview him. I'd love to interview him, ask him all these questions, Nick. Come on, fess up, mate. And but no, he doesn't want to, apparently. I hear through a mutual friend he's not interested.
So, what were his like, if you get specific, what were his like intellectual interests? What did he read? Because I remember on our phone call you mentioned that he had you read William Gibson and Friedrich Nietzsche.
Well, no,
What
there
kind
was
of
lots
work
of
did he read?
cultural stuff that Nick would share, right? So, and it was all pretty much all good, apart from, I mean, Nietzsche, he was really enthusiastic about. I didn't like that. I read Beyond Good and Evil, which he prompted me to read, and Also Spake Zarathustra. No, mate, not this is just not me. He was into the French writers, Camus, that lot. That didn't really float my boat either. But some stuff did. I mean, who else was it he was into musically that I didn't really like? Oh God, Iggy Pop. It wasn't really me, but some stuff I loved it. I mean, he first introduced me to an album which I still love to this day, Made in Japan by Deep Purple, which was a double album which had only just come out back then. And I think it was maybe 1971, actually, but that we listened to it just a few years after it was out. And Deep Purple was still a big thing, playing at the Hammersmith Odeon, things like that. And that was fantastic and still is fantastic. He was into Led Zeppelin, which is this sort of slightly satanic lot, which I wasn't so keen on. Jimi Hendrix, he was Electric Ladyland. He lent me a copy of that, I think. And so, but in terms of writing, yeah, William Gibson, I did like. I did read a couple of William Gibson novels, and in a way, of course, this introduces us to the internet, because William Gibson was writing about this sort of thing, the sort of high tech future and battles that would take place over firewalls and whatever. But Nick told me about the internet back way back then. He explained it to me, and obviously, it sits in the back of your mind. And then was it 15 years later, 17, 18 years later, suddenly there's something called the internet is being announced on, and you can get yourself something called email, which no one's ever heard of before. Nick was just talking about this nearly 20 years before it happened, so I'd like to know how he knew about all these things.
So, what was that conversation like when he was telling you about the internet, if you can
Well, it's
remember?
as most things with Nick, it was a one-way conversation. He's just telling me, spelling it out. This is what's going to happen. And I'm sitting there going, wow, okay, right, okay. And I didn't know anything about it, but he did, and he knew exactly. I mean, I think since I understand the internet much more, and it's funny because when I stopped working at the BBC, the internet was there. This is mid 1990s, as a place for all the research that I'd been doing, which wasn't going to end up in a program anymore. I could just put that and put it up on the internet as like my filing cabinet, you know. So there's loads of research and information I was working on at the time, and the internet was brilliant for that. But I was sort of forewarned by Nick that was coming along. So yeah, it was just a bit eerie, really, to hear when it actually started happening. I'm immediately thinking, hang on, Nick told me about this ages ago. And he was right, wasn't he? How did he know? How did he know? I suppose it's because if you think about what the internet developed from, it was World War, Cold War technology, really. And the idea was that in a nuclear attack, you need to have a communication system that will work when major nodes are nuked. And it's a decentralized network. And that's what the internet was. I mean, it was developed from this idea of having a communication system where the country could communicate and be run, as I assume, despite maybe London, Birmingham, Glasgow, you know, a lot of major centres, including communication centres, being vaporised. So that. I don't think Nick talked about that at the time. I don't think so, no. But that's what it is.
So, what was your experience like at the time when you knew Nick, like with the culture of drugs? Was it something that was like present in your social circle or with
Well,
Nick?
look, I mean, all loads of kids were interested in drugs, mainly smoking hash, mainly, you know, sort of Red Lib, Black Moroccan man. And of course, quite a lot of youngsters. This is a good way, I suppose, to get youngsters into smoking, if you can use the word good. So there was lots of that around. Most of the kids at school had either tried it. Obviously, well, it's not so obvious now, but the culture at the time, the parents were generally against it, so it was something that we had to sort of keep hidden. But Nick was really interested in hallucinogenic drugs. He wasn't so interested in that other stuff. And I mean, I can remember thinking at the time, he's right, you know, this dope, what is rubbish? This hallucinogenic. I started reading up on hallucinogenic drugs, and of course, I'm agreeing with him, really. This is much more interesting. This is a sort of mind altering, mind expanding. You know, you've got to be careful how you label these things. And it certainly looks like it's not like alcohol, because we were quite new to alcohol at the time as well. So as teenagers, you do experiment with these things. I would still say this to this day. You have to be with hallucinogenic drugs extremely careful, very, very tiny micro amounts, as you start to understand what it is. And I can remember having a really tiny amount and seeing just really tiny changes in my consciousness and perception and what I could see around me. That was around about age 17, I think. So that I think was when we were maybe 16, when we were in the first year of sixth form, potentially. But Nick said he got the stuff from, I think it was was it the Three Tuns pub, which is South End Road, which was down towards Lewisham, which has now been demolished, which was had a no notoriety at the time as a big biker pub. And it's funny because when I met Nick later in life, he had a biker mate of his called Iggy, who apparently was manufacturing LSD at Sussex University Organic Chemistry Labs, and running it, and the bikers were running it around the country. But I was never really against. I mean, my own view on these drugs is that it doesn't really make sense to just simply prohibit them, because people are going to deal in them anyway in the black market. So they, I think, just should be openly talked about and quite thoroughly regulated, so that we have, I think, a mature attitude in society. I mean, let's if you go back hundreds of years, thousands of years even, societies before the Romans were using these drugs, the magic mushrooms and things like that. So let's just have a mature attitude, I think, and a sensible regime which keeps them away from young kids, as much needs to be kept away from the youngsters. And nowadays they seem to have, there seems to be an attitude of, let's prohibit everything. And what happens then, of course, is organized crime have a field day.
So how do you think drugs impacted Nick? Like long term, short term, what effects did they have?
Well, it did sort of change his personality. It changed, I think, everyone's personality. That had anything to do with it, really, because we had a sort of, I think it was like people who have experienced. It was almost like a kind of rite of passage in a way. People who have and haven't experienced this. I mean, I went to visit him down at Sussex University. I'm trying to think. Probably it would have been that in his first year there, I don't know what happened because I don't think he got his degree from Sussex. So it may be he flunked out there and went somewhere else to do his degree. But while he was down there, he was just the same old Nick, but he was just a bit more. I think after the, he was apparently, one of his flatmates was telling me he was doing acid almost every day. And she was saying, it's just too much, this guy's doing too much, he's too obsessed. But that was Nick. He would have a obsession, get on, have do loads and loads and loads of it. He was not a man for mediocre stuff or little doing little bits. He was a man of excess, he wanted to do things absolutely to the full. He was also into, he told me, and other people told me, he was into speed as well, amphetamines. And but I wasn't interested in that at all. It was the LSD side of things which made me, which got me. And he had something else called STP. I don't know quite what that is, but it's very similar. But as a personality, yeah, I mean, he was pretty much the same Nick. In fact, when I went to see him down there, he first thing he did was got out a game. Okay, let's play a game. And Sussex University was a brilliant campus. I mean, it had a fantastic student union, a very, very liberal, libertarian, anything goes kind of, let's explore the unexplorable at Sussex University. So that, I think, was possibly the last time I saw him. I did speak to him afterwards, but yeah, but he was a similar. It was almost like, the hallucinogenic drugs kind of hyped him even more, but that may have been the speed, of course.
Because there was a quote you said on our phone call that really sort of stuck with me. It was a hyperdrive on his dark side, which
Well, it, I mean, that's what's happened since. I don't think that was the case back then, but I mean, I've spoken to various people who've known Nick over the years, people who've been taught by him, because he then went on to teach at Warwick University, which is a sort of business place, basically. It's a business school, which to me is like the evil empire, And I mean, I'm a socialist. I believe in a mixed economy. I believe that most of economic activity should be run in the state's interest, in the national interest, like we had after World War II, railways, water. All these things. Otherwise, what's the point in voting if some big corporation owns everything? There's no point at all, and you're not in a democracy. But then Nick understood that, and that was he was on the other side of that to me. So Warwick, I know he was getting into some really like dark stuff. Like I say, I know because, but I'm hearing it secondhand that he was trying to conjure demons, and he was always making some sort of an effort to push what should, I mean, it was because he was from Sutton Coalfield. I think when his father moved, or I'm not sure if they ever lived in South Africa, but they definitely had this South African connection. His dad did. They were in Sutton Coalfield. So when he went back to Warwick, in a way, he was going back to where he'd been before, and they took up lodging in Aleister Crowley's old house. So this is, I mean, funnily enough, Aleister Crowley also has a connection to near where we were on Hayes Common, because if you go back to the Second World War, I think it was just after, maybe just before, maybe the 30s, Crowley was refused permission to come and talk to the Poetry Society at Oxford University, and because he'd done that, he was refused. There was some letter correspondence to Crowley at a place called Keston Park, which is actually directly connected to where we were doing our British Free Army training. So, I mean, I think there's a bit of psychogeography here. Crowley had places all over. I mean, he's in just outside Bristol. There was some place he apparently stayed. I keep getting told by various Bristolians. So actually going to live in Crowley's old place, and that's a bit weird, isn't it? What's he doing that for? Conjuring demons, what's he doing that for? And then the other thing I've heard, I mean, this is, of course, it will probably be denied by the university, but apparently he was for a while, he set up this thing called the CCRU, Cybernetic Culture Research Unit, which was obviously a sort of precursor for, or it was just as the internet was just arriving. I mean, Nick was all ready for it with his brilliant pitch to Warwick saying, look, let's have this. And Warwick, of course, got recognised all around the world for that. But Nick was way ahead of the game, as usual. What else about Warwick? He was feeding LSD apparently, or hallucinogenic drugs of some kind, to some of his pupils. Now, it may be he wasn't actually feeding them; they had decided, yeah, I'd like to try some of that, like I did. So there's no real reason other than the law. That around drugs, which I mean I don't agree with anyway, but the there's no real reason why the university should even know about it. But obviously it got back to them maybe through some kids' parents. Or of course the other thing is if you're feeding people large amounts of LSD, they can go completely mad, and possibly their whole brain will fail for the rest of their lives. So it's just extremely dangerous stuff to be playing around, certainly to be like pushing around like candy. And that's why the law, I suppose, is like it is a bit, although it isn't really talked about properly. So anyway, that's what I heard from people who knew him, is that that's what had happened at Warwick. And I think it was while it was at Warwick that I last spoke to him. That was when I was still at the BBC in 93 in Salisbury. I just thought, oh, I wonder what Nick is up to. And I found some reference to him being at Warwick. So I phoned up Warwick University and they actually just put me through to his office and I spoke to him there. And he said to me, well, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm at the BBC now. And he just sounded nervous. So I was like, oh, I don't know why. I don't know why he sounded nervous. Maybe it's because, he has plans. People like him have plans for media and broadcasting, and he didn't want people like me hanging around. I mean, remember, this era is where the BBC was basically being destroyed. I mean, literally, all the best people were being, well, destroyed, sacked. And 93, I think, was the year that the Time Watch Gladio film went out on the BBC, Alan Frankovich's film all about NATO, which Nick was such a big fan of, blowing up civilians all over Europe and blaming it on the Soviet Union. I mean, that three-part series is one of the best things the BBC have ever done. But of course, that from an elite NATO Nazi point of view was a disaster and they had to shut it down. So I would put Nick alongside the people who were looking at the BBC at the time as a very, very dangerous threat to their rise to power.
Have you seen Nick's current Twitter account? Have you seen the stuff that he puts online?
Yeah, I'm not really impressed. I mean, he just seems very negative. Also, I read his book, his first book, and I didn't really like it. But I can see some of his stuff is quite articulate. He's basically saying nowadays, look, we're way ahead of you, everybody else around the world. We are 10, and of course, Nick is notorious for being ahead of people, right? And that's what he was like. And all these people, as they catch up with what we're up to, it's going to be too late, basically. So that's his attitude. And there's a sort of almost, I think, kind of childish, naughty boy kind of syndrome around it, even though, of course, it has its really deeply evil aspect, this idea of trying to start a nuclear war, and encouraging things like the Order of Nine Angles, Nick is a supporter of, and Atombuff, and these very, deeply sinister organizations of the far right. I don't know if you've looked into those, have you?
I've looked into it.
What do you make of them?
It's a dangerous ideology. It's really it's difficult to find the direct link between Nick and those groups, but it is clear that there is some kind of sympathy
Well, yeah,
between Nick
he
and
has sympathy for them,
extremism.
you know, he has sympathy for them, and that doesn't surprise me. It was the sort of person he was. You know, he liked the idea of sort of doing everything cloak and dagger behind the scenes. And what these organizations are basically like death cults. So they're the idea is you get promoted through the cult through killing people and more extreme violence. And I find it disgusting and extraordinary that you get Palestine Action proscribed in Britain, right? You know, this is a non-violent group which is trying to stop a genocide, is proscribed, and there's no mention, no prescription for the Order of Nine Angles, which is a Nazi satanic cult which wants to recruit people to commit assassinations to rise up through the organization. Far right. Now, why, what government, what Home Office in its right mind can see? They're not obviously not working for us. So the government has been captured very much as Nick wanted, you know, hasn't it? You know, that's Nick's idea. You capture the government and you have your people infiltrate it, they steer it in an evil direction, and then everyone says, oh, democracy is not working, you know. So then the fascists go, okay, we'll take over.
So would you say the current Nick surprises you? If you
No,
ask
not at
if you
all, not at all. It's the natural progression of teenage Nick to a position of a kind of Fourth Reich that we're living through now, which is a sort of financial, technocratic, fascist, Nazi, satanic ideology. And of course, the Nazis were satanic. I mean, their SS cult was satanic. The whole they called it at the time, you know, my grandparents' generation called it the crooked cross. You know, they'd taken the Christian morals and they just snap, 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 and you get a swastika, don't you? So it's also, of course, related, I think, to the Eastern religions, the Hindu style. This idea of a pantheistic, you know, lots of different gods, and also nature worship, ancestor worship. But actually, Nick's particular brand, I think, is basically self-worship, which is the satanic thing, which is, look, you know, nobody else matters, only you. And it's like Ayn Rand, you know, Atlas Shrugged, creating a so-called philosophy around the idea of, no God, you know. So you're the most important one. Anyone that believes in God deserves to be killed in this social Darwinist survivor of the fittest, and you're in charge, you know. So it's interesting, isn't it, that Nick has come from this corporate world, his father working for Shell, you know, that the battle has been over the decades with the Rockefellers monopolizing vertical integration of the oil industry, undermining the democracy in America, the oil industry now calling the shots in so many ways in the UK, you know, having massive profits through this illegal, unprovoked war in the Gulf with Trump and the Iranians. And of course, it's a spiritual battle. As Catherine Austin Fitz says, it's a war on God. But God's going to win. And on the good side are the Abrahamic faiths, that's the Orthodox Church in Russia, and Shia Islam in Iran. And in my own view, and this is, I think, why Nick has gone to China and is in Shanghai, is that actually there's a lot of similarities between the techno obsession in the United States and, you know, with Musk and the rest and Thiel. And China, and they're both basically the same, even though they want to have a war. It's a little bit like the authoritarianism that was going on in the 1930s in Soviet Russia and Nazi Germany. On the surface, they're completely different, but actually, when you get down to it, you've got your secret police, locking up, killing, executing political dissidents and anyone that speaks their mind against the government. And that's starting to happen with ICE and things like that, and protesters against ICE in the States. It's been happening for a long time, hasn't it, in America, with things like COINTELPRO, the FBI executing Fred Hampton, and all these things like Martin Luther King's execution, the CIA and the Chicago Mafia executing JFK in the 1960s. And so you've got a similar authoritarianism in China now. So, but China is clearly working. I mean, it's what I would, the reason I think it's working well over there is it's a mixed economy, but it's a sort of marketized version of communism, which is much more successful than America. And I don't think anyone in their right mind, looking from a sort of accelerationist point of view, but what China don't have, of course, is God. They don't have a strong moral tradition. And you've got this ridiculous situation with President Xi. You're not allowed to, you must sing the national anthem. You're not allowed to laugh during the national anthem. This is all starting to get very, very authoritarian in China. So I mean, my own view is that the reason the Russians are a target is because the America and China can't have their war, because if they do, the Russians will clean up afterwards. So they really hate the Russians. Not only do they hate the original Christian Orthodox Church that's based there, obviously the Catholics. They started in the 4th century with Constantine, and they've always been dodgy. Right, so the Catholics were always set up by the Roman Empire to control Christianity, not to really represent it, with all sorts of weird doctrines. And then we had the Reformation in the 16th century, and the Protestants were even worse. In other words, they wanted a form of Christianity which was going to allow mass exploitation, factories, empire building, and far worse things than the morals from the Catholic Church ever allowed. And they also wanted to cause a religious conflict. Peter Ford, the former ambassador to Syria, was pointing out on the program I do a couple of weeks ago that there are amazing similarities between the rivalry between Protestants and Catholics, and on the other hand, the rivalry in Islam between Shia and Sunni. So you've got a sort of ruling class. You go to Ireland, they'll tell you about this ruling class Protestants and subservient Catholics, and you've got ruling class Sunnis and subservient Shia. And also, a lot of the doctrine is very, very similar. I won't go into all that, but I think that's a manipulation. And actually, the truth is that we do have to stick to the Ten Commandments, that this is written in stone, as Moses would say. And if you start to veer away from it, what you're doing is you're basically shooting your father, or slapping your father, kicking your father, which is the real reason we're all here, because there is obviously something much more interesting and deeper than just people having kids. I mean, this is not an evolution world. This is a world that's been intelligently designed. We just had the eclipse the other day, right, where everyone's looking up at the sun with their kind of, hopefully with their little black screens that they're looking through, and then you're watching a designed solar system where you've got a sun 93 million miles away, which is exactly the same size as a moon, which is a quarter of a million miles away. So how on earth did you get those to be the same size? That's quite a feat. That to me is, and also this whole business of waking up every day, it's like a kind of rebirth every day, and this idea that you're going to die and that's it forever. No, something happens afterwards. And I mean, I have my own stories about my faith, which really, I mean, I won't go into now, but Nick got me at aged 18 to really question whether there's a God or not. And I did, what I will say is, I did grab him. This is when we were at Langley Park in the sixth form. I would be just about 18, I think, maybe 17, because I've been wrestling with all this, after knowing Nick. You've got to think about these sorts of things. And I grabbed him on the stairs. I actually grabbed his arm. So, Nick, what about God? What do you think? Does he exist or not? Because we had conversations along these lines, but he'd never really committed himself. And he looked at me and he said, "Well, Tony, it's kind of 50-50, really, isn't it? I think Maybe not, 50-50. And then he ran off up the stairs. That was one of the last conversations I ever had at school with him. And so I grappled with that question, and it was shown and proven to me by God, right, that there is a God. I came very, very close to the edge in a very sticky situation, and God made his presence known to me. And so I've been grateful for that ever since. And I'm actually very grateful to Nick as well for the education he gave me, without which I possibly would never have found God at all. And I've been wandering through my life from the year 18 onwards, having not known whether there's a God or not. I mean, what's the point of living a life without knowing the answer to that question?
Yeah. So with Nick on God, do you think he still believes it's 50-50? What do you think his stance is like today?
Well, you could ask him, but he probably would give you an oblique answer.
Yeah.
You know,
Seeing how he interacts with
he holds
questions
his
online.
cards very close to his chest, yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, with like his relationship with Curtis Yarvin, and I mean, they are in a tradition which has been around for a long, long time, and they're moving us into this techno-feudalism. They are being very successful because of the amount of wealth that's behind them, but this is it's essentially like a kind of power cult where you can get rich and wealthy so long as you sell your soul and become
Yeah.
selfish and you turn against the rest of humanity. Well, my philosophy is totally the opposite.
So, is there a are there any like childhood friends, any other connections to Nick that you think we could get in touch with, or anyone that has insight beyond yours, anyone that
Well,
we could reach out to?
I'm happy to talk about that to them and to you afterwards if they're up for something. Yeah. I
Yeah.
mean, I don't know that any of them would have as much insight as me. My brother, he wouldn't talk about it, you know what I mean? There's loads of people that wouldn't talk about it. I even
Yeah.
spoke to my brother about Nick recently, and he said, "Oh, I don't want to talk about that." Now, hang on, Nick has become one of the most notorious, the father of accelerationism. This is actually the hidden religion, actually, in the West these days. If you go along with Zionism, if you go along with greed, selfishness, the religion of money, you'll find yourself fast-tracked, you know, through universities into well-paid jobs, but you do have to sell your soul to do it. And isn't it ironic that, you know, Winston Churchill's speech, "Their Finest Hour," you know, about the British in the Second World War making a stand against the Nazi tyranny, the absolute evil, satanic empire that Hitler and people around him created, that we should now be leading the charge in the next world war. Actually, Britain, I think, you know, if you look at the RAF's role, for example, in the Middle East, doing surveillance for the Israeli genocide, flying out from Akrotiri in Cyprus, we have basically become the Luftwaffe, you know. We've become the tyrants of the skies, and so it's been a massive turn. It's funny, it's ironic because I had a couple of my immediate relatives, uncles, in the Royal Air Force in World War II, and I just find it the whole way that Britain is behaving these days. It's going down this dark Enlightenment accelerationist World War III direction, which they cannot win it. There will just be massive carnage. This is the sort of thing Nick used to relish as a teenager. But why on earth we're doing this is God only knows. And the irony here is that all of those people that died in World War I, not so much because that really was an insane war, but particularly fighting Hitler in World War II, it's like they're spitting on all these war memorials, spitting on all these graveyards, the Commonwealth graveyards. What those people died for was not to start another world war alongside a Operation Paperclip Nazi style America, you know, that's kicking its way around the world and prepared to use nuclear weapons. You know, it starts Trump flippantly talking about nuking Iran, the Israelis flippantly talking about nuking Europe or Iran. And that is that we have become everything that those people died to stop, which is really concerning. I would just maybe wind up by mentioning my book, which I did, which is called The Traitors of Arnhem, Martin Bormann and the Bilderberg Group. And although a lot of people know about Operation Paperclip, with all these Nazi technology going to the United States, nuclear technology, MK Ultra technology, etc., going to America, and these Nazi war criminals being given new names, etc., in the States for the Cold War. What's not well known is Britain's role and the relationship between Desmond Morton, who was Churchill's private secretary, and this guy, Martin Bormann, who was Hitler's private secretary. And what I've uncovered is the connection between the Battle of Arnhem, which was actually thrown by the British. We deliberately lost that battle in the form of one of the senior commanders, Browning, threw the battle to, in order to give the Nazis more time to squirrel their wealth away around the world to start a financial Fourth Reich after the war. But it was also a way of making the British fail, because World War II was all about the Americans are now the big empire, the British are no longer. So and then there was an organization, the Bilderberg Conferences, which was started a decade after that battle in Arnhem, at Oosterbeek in Arnhem, which is where the battle took place, as a sort of in joke. And this Bilderberg Conference, we've been, me and many others have been following since, which is effectively a sort of NATO private lobby to make sure that pro-NATO, anti-Soviet politicians get implanted in power ever since the 1950s. And that's what's taken place. Slowly but surely, any independent-minded politician, such as Jeremy Corbyn, they are nobbled and by whatever means, such as John Smith. Such as Robin Cook. These people are nobbled by the Bilderbergers. So we have actually not got a democracy in Europe at all anymore. These people insist on all the NATO countries in controlling who gets into politics. And so that's what my book is about, and the seamless links between the British. Obviously, we had a Nazi king, Edward VIII, and the Nazis. So there are books around that also suggest that that the British and American intelligence services were very, very close to Hitler in the run-up to the war. They knew exactly what was going on. Of course, the establishment view was we need to build Hitler up in the 1930s to be a bulwark against the Soviet Union, after the Russian Revolution. And then, of course, it all backfired. But all that looted money, the billion or so dollars that the Nazis looted from Europe during World War II. What my book shows that it all came back to London in the form of Martin Bormann, the Czech signatory, and then the he set up the 750 companies when he was in South America, into which all this money was laundered from the Second World War, and that is the Fourth Reich effectively. It's these businesses where often Jewish people were put in charge of these companies, Zionists normally, obviously. But the idea was if you put a Jewish chairman in charge of a company which is containing this money that's been laundered through Sullivan and Cromwell, the Dulles Brothers law firm, then no one will suspect that it's a Nazi-funded company. It was a very clever thing, and the books to read on that is one is Op JB by Christopher Crichton, The Last Great Secret of the Second World War, which explains what happened at the end of the war with getting Bormann out of Berlin. And then there's Paul Manning's Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, which talks about Bormann over in South America basically creating this Fourth Reich as a financial empire after World War II.
Well, just on the latter end of the interview, I was wondering if there's any anything I haven't asked or anything that you think belongs in a biographical piece on Land. Any anecdotes that like would reflect his trajectory later in life, or if you have any photos
Well,
of him.
he's great fun. Nick was great fun, actually. I mean, he would get us doing things which would always there'd always be some. Always remember Rob. He was with our little squad of British Free Army guerrillas running around on Hayes Common training with Nick as our leader. Rob was the first aid guy. He had a little first aid box, and one it was so ironic. One of the things Nick was planning just by the pond across from his house is what we got is these big bits of bamboo. We got one of his mum's kitchen knives attached to the end. The idea was we were supposed to be like throwing these things like spears to hit a tree. Anyway, one of us threw the spear and it bounced off the tree and it went straight through Rob's foot. Right. Luckily, he's got his, and he panicked. He panicked. Because, and of course, we had to run him back. I'm not sure. I think his Nick's mum patched him up, actually, but there was lots of blood came out. And this was the sort of thing that Nick would, you wouldn't think that that would happen, right? But it did. And it was inevitable. There were a few scrapes during those sorts of training. Also, really, I wouldn't be who I am without meeting Nick. So obviously, I owe him a great gratitude. But I just wish he would, number one, do an interview, and number two, start to think a little bit more about his kids and humanity, open his heart up a little bit, because this is the trouble with the LSD and the hallucinogenic drugs, is it can get into your head and you could go crazy. I mean, what he's doing in a way, I don't know if he probably does realize it and he doesn't care, is he's creating this kind of anti-human world where we of Nazis on acid. So this is obviously dodgy and dangerous. That you have to be quite careful with things like LSD, because a lot of people believe that what they're seeing when they're having hallucinations is the real world. Loads of people are like that. I believe I've had some amazing insight. No. This is just your imagination, mate. And there is obviously you're slightly connecting to the other side using that. And there are some insights that you gain. But to start to think that this dream world of LSD is more real than reality, well, my God, you've really lost it.